and for those of you who are new to Insights, I am Dee Dee's sister, and I've been with her since the beginning. We've kind of run this journey of Insights together and have had a ball. And I used to come on Tuesday nights, but I switched over to Thursday nights Insights, so greetings from the Orion group. We have a fun time just like you guys. I do see every now and then people nodding off, but that's fine. If you need to take a nap, Jesus loves you sleeping. One of the women actually last year fell asleep, and poor thing was right on the front row as I was teaching Thursday night, and afterwards she was so embarrassed. I said, listen, haven't you read the verse that he gives his beloved sleep? It's one of the things. So if you need to sleep, don't feel bad. I'll pretend you're praying for me. But if you have been in Insights, you may have, and you've never done a Bethmore study, you may have done your homework this week and gone, wow, this is really different than what we normally do in Insights. And actually, this first week's lesson is really different than what Beth usually does. So you'll see in the weeks to come, you're going to get a little bit more in the book of Acts. You'll get a little more in Paul's writings. But this first week, she really took us through history. And I thought it was incredible. I loved it. It was a lot of reading and a lot of stretching for my poor brain. But I'm just so appreciative of the work that she put into this so I can just open her book and start studying. But we are looking at a character study rather than a book of the Bible, so we will be jumping around. And so as I was trying to think of what to do with this, and Andrea Gibbs, who's part of our Tuesday Morning Insights, came over and she was helping me try to figure out an outline, because I am terrible at outlines. If you guys have been around with me, there have been times all you got was a pretty piece of paper in the back. I didn't even have an outline, but Andrea's been helping me. So I decided, what if, you know, if you're doing a character study, if we're looking at the life of Paul, what it would be like to maybe put Paul's life in a movie? What would his life look like as a movie? And if you're going to write have a good movie, you need a good screenplay. I know nothing about theater, you guys. I've never done anything with theater or arts or drama or dancing. I was a criminal justice major. I was into crime, not dancing. And so, but I decided to have some fun with this, and I looked up a glossary of screenplay words, and that's what you see on your outline. I probably have misused every one of these words, so if you are a person in the theater and the arts and you write screenplays, forgive me, I'm just having fun, because my motto is, if it's not fun, why bother doing it? And so if we were going to look at Paul's life, we're going to put it in a movie, what would our screenplay look like? And the first thing that you have to have for a screenplay is what they call a logline, and that is simply the story in one active sentence. And as I was reading the homework, I felt like on page 20, Beth Moore put an incredible sentence that it totally stopped me in my tracks as I read it. Nothing in Saul's life would be a waste unless he refused to let God use it. All would be part of God's ornate plan. I went, really, Beth? Nothing's a waste? Nothing in Paul's life is a waste? And if that's true, is that true for me? Is nothing a waste in my life if I place it in God's hands? So with that question, or that active sentence, our logline, let's jump in and see what we can find out. So in screenplays, there can be, and I'm talking like I really know what I'm talking about. It's so funny because I don't know anything about writing a screenplay. I'm having so much fun pretending. Anyway. Back to my professor, my theater professor mode. There is an A story. Possibly you can have an A story and a B story. The B story of a screenplay is the backstory. It's what happens underneath. It's the context. It's everything that might have possibly come before the movie starts playing. And so this past week, our homework really was the B story. We have been looking at the backstory of Saul's life. And I'd love to just, again, I don't want to insult you. I'm sure every one of you did your homework, and I'm sure you did every single page. I know that. But I'd like to review it a little bit and maybe add a few more things. So the background story, the B story in Saul's movie, or Saul's, the screenplay I'm writing, starts probably with two major groups, people groups in his backstory, the Jews and the Romans. The Jews, just to give their backstory, leading up to the time where we meet Saul this week, they have been given about, I don't know, over 1,000 years before Saul, they were given the law. Moses was given the law. God gave it to Moses to give to the people. And in this law, God was teaching them how to love God, how to love others, how to live together in community, how to live and worship with him. And he said, if you do this, if you obey these, I will prosper you. You will have crops and lands and all this good stuff. Well, if you don't, though, God said, if you don't obey these things, you will not prosper. And in fact, I will bring other nations, the enemies around you, and they will come in. They will destroy your land, your temple, your worship, and they will carry you off into their lands as their slaves and captives. The whole Old Testament pretty much summarizes this problem that the Israelites tried at times, and they followed God, but then they didn't follow God, and they followed God, and then they didn't follow God, and after hundreds of years, God finally did bring in the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and they destroyed the temple. They destroyed their crops, their vineyards, their cities, and they carried the people off. Well, a few hundred years later, under Ezra and Nehemiah, two more books in the Old Testament that tell this story, this backstory, the people began to come back to Jerusalem. God gathered them back. Not everyone. Some people stayed because they had had a good time in Assyria or Babylon, or maybe they made some good money, married a Babylonian girl, and so they stayed. But many did come back. They rebuilt the temple. It was never as grand as what Solomon had built, but it was pretty good. And they had rebuilt the temple. They rebuilt their city. And this is about at the time where we're going to join Saul. But there was one other group in this picture of this background story, and that's the Romans. Now, I didn't know anything about the Romans except, you know, Hollywood, and I don't think Hollywood really knows that much either. So I went to the library. And I looked at all these books on the Romans, and I went, oh my goodness, these are really big books. You know, they have a lot of writing in them. This is just to confess to you that obviously when I was in high school, I never paid attention in my history classes. And like I said, I was a criminal justice major. I didn't take any history when I got to college. That was just something. So I am an amateur, but I'm really excited about history now, and I love it. So please be careful with what you repeat that I'm saying. I am not a professor. I'm pretending to be a screenplay writer, and now I'm pretending to be a historian. I'm having all sorts of pretend fun this morning or tonight. So please be careful with what you repeat. But I think I know a little bit, but to always double check anything I say. So I went to the library, was totally overwhelmed. And then I remembered, I used to be on the K-Kids staff, our children's staff here, writing curriculum, so you know where I went? The children's section. You guys, this is incredible. Look, this is all about the art and religion of Rome, and look at, there's like these really big pictures, and then really big type, you know, and then there's another really big, and it was amazing, and I thought, oh, I can get this, and you know, so I got a couple of the children's books and worked my way through, and eventually, yep, I did it. I got through the big girl book, and it was a pretty exciting moment. And one of the things that's so interesting, because we focus so much in our studies of insights on everything in the Bible, but in the scheme of things, we think, well, I mean, the Israelites are talked about on every page, right, of the Old Testament, and then again so much in the New Testament, but in the bigger picture of the world, they were a very small, tiny little group of people on the planet. And when I got to find where the interaction with the Romans, with Jerusalem, or the Jewish people, or even the Christians, it was just a few little paragraphs here and there. I mean, look at this book, and there's not big, big, pretty pictures. It's all like this, you guys, lots of writing. But it was just little, tiny things, because they were such a small part of the Roman Empire in terms of the worldview. But obviously, in God's view, they were the story that he was telling. So, let me tell you what I found out about the Romans. And again, please, please double check everything. But it is interesting. So we come up to this point of time where they have their temple, they have their land. It's not quite what it ever was under Solomon or David, but they're back in their land. They're back pretty autonomous. But Rome is the empire of the world. And Rome and Pompeii in about 64 BC. And this book even said, we're not really sure why, but for some reason, Pompeii kind of made, he was going down to Egypt where things were good for the pickings. You know, if you're going to conquer a nation, conquer Egypt. They've got money, gold, you know, everything. And on his way, he just happened to take a little side route, like running over to a 7-Eleven, and decided to lay siege to Jerusalem. And they said, we don't even know why. Jerusalem wasn't even that big of shakes. There wasn't much there. It's just those, you know, troublesome Jews. That's all there was there. But for whatever reason, which I think God had a reason, that Pompeii went into Jerusalem, lay siege for about 3 months, 6 months, something like that, and in the battle ended up killing 12,000 Jewish people, and only a few Romans died in the fall of Jerusalem. And at that point in time, they became like what's called a citizen state or something like that, but they came under the rule of Rome about 64 BC. So, you know, 50, 60 years before Saul enters the world, Rome has now taken over the Jewish world of his day. One of the other interesting things is Rome did not practice separation of church and state like America does. The religion of Rome was practiced by the political leaders. The political leaders actually functioned like the priests within their communities. In the beginning of the Roman Empire, the Roman gods were spirits, and they saw spirit in everything. The door frames had spirits. In fact, one of the books had this whole thing on spirit door frames. So I don't know why your doorway has a spirit, but they thought there was a spirit in the doorway. There's spirits in flights of birds or the entrails of slaughtered animals. They saw all these signs and messages from the gods in these things or from these spirits. And they would base their decisions on what they did as a government on what they called auspices. And auspices were simply reading the signs that came before them. I know some of you might have a little wicked thinking like I do, and you're going, oh, what a great racket, right? I'm the leader. I see this auspice and this auspice. The way the paper's laying on my thing says you guys should all pay me $1 million to be speaking to you tonight. This is what the gods want. You know, you can see that a charismatic leader or a manipulative or whatever, they could use this to gain power, which it sounds like many times they did. But many times they actually believed that these were the spirits talking to them. Well, as Rome began to conquer all these other countries, they took on their gods, because Rome loved to collect gods. Whatever gods were in that land, they wanted to worship them too. They would rename them, give them Roman names. And as they conquered the Greeks, they gave all these little spirits they had, they gave them human attributes. And they took on the Greek gods and gave them, you know, the Roman names. And they actually then began to do what is called the imperial cult, which is where they would deify their dead emperors. So suddenly the emperors became called sons of God. They were the sons of God in the Roman Empire, and they were worshipped, and it was very important. And so Rome said, you know, this, it worked great for most of the countries that they overran or conquered, because they said, listen, you can worship any way you want. We love all your gods, as long as you don't deny the role of the official state. In other words, as long as you go along with our decrees, as we look at the auspices and the signs from the gods and make these decisions, and you just get along with all these gods. Okay, and you might, if you're awake, you're thinking, okay, that would work for Egypt, that would probably work for Asia Minor, that would work for the Greeks, those kinds of, that kind of arrangement. I don't see this working for the Jews or the Christians. Because the Jews and the Christians said, no, there is one true God. They were monotheist, not polytheist. And so for a while, there was this awkward collaboration between Rome and the Jews. And it was during the time of Jesus and during the time of Saul that this awkward collaboration. And when you read the Gospels and you read the struggle Pilate had at the trial of Jesus, it was because he's trying to figure out, why are these people so difficult? Why can't we all just get along? Why can't we all just love all the gods and everybody just love everybody's gods? And Pilate couldn't get a monotheist point of view. And so this is kind of the era. Eventually, if you know history, the Romans finally said, done. That's it. They drove out all the Jews, wiped out everything. Tiberius came in, wiped out the temple. Just, we're done. We are done with this. But back in the day, they were trying. And Pompey, when he came in 64 BC, did not destroy the temple. He entered it and realized, oh, I just desecrated it. He didn't realize that to enter the temple as a non-Jew would desecrate it. So the next day after he entered it, he had it cleansed and the rituals reinstituted. So Rome was trying. And I think a lot of it was God was behind this, working this out to create this environment where Jesus and eventually Saul could spread the gospel throughout the Roman world using the powers and authority and roads and infrastructure that Rome had during that day. Well, let's zoom in just a little bit. I'll keep going with this and then we'll move on. But like I said, I'm dangerous when it comes to history. I'm having so much fun. But I also want to contrast that, what we just learned about Jerusalem and how they got along with Rome, with Tarsus, where Saul grew up. Tarsus was not a Jewish city. It was originally, well, it was owned by everybody because it's on the southern part of Turkey. It is still called Tarsus today. And it's a very prominent, it was a very, very prominent city because it sits right on the sea and it's a good place to get to with all the trade routes. And so the Greeks were ruling Tarsus when Pompey came through and he conquered or took over Tarsus and it became a Roman city around 66 BC. So again, right before Saul is, you know, born, but where his probably his grandfather or grandparents are living, Tarsus becomes a Roman city. That is very important because at some point during the history, during this time leading up to the first century, everyone in Tarsus was given Roman citizenship because Tarsus was made the capital of this Roman community, of this Roman state. And it was a very prominent city. It had universities, some of the best cultures, some of the greatest learning and studies. It was a very wealthy city. They had this amazing linen manufacturing that they would take goat hair and make this, apparently this incredible fabric that would be made into tents. So there were a lot of tent makers in the city of Tarsus, and it was very wealthy. It was very culturally prominent. And up until that, during that time, a small group of Jews were relocated by one of the Greek kings, relocated a group of Jews into the city of Tarsus. They often did this, taking them from around different places in their kingdom when they needed workers for certain things. So most people believe it was probably, that's how this Jewish community that Saul grew up in got started in Tarsus. And this Jewish community in Tarsus would not have mingled with the Greek and Roman and Persian and Medes and all the different people groups in the city of Tarsus. They would have kept in their own little enclave, trying to keep themselves pure and separate and different from this Roman Greek city of all the prominence. So here's the environment Saul is growing up in. And I did find a picture. Tarsus, I mean, it's wonderful that this lovely city's sitting there, but it's sitting on top of all the different layers of life that have been in Tarsus. But they did uncover, this is a Roman road, and I can't tell because I'm not an archaeologist. That'll be my next thing. I'll try to pretend to be someday. But there's a drainage system. They uncovered this Roman road, and there's a very sophisticated drainage system they found when they began to uncover this. And realized that it was a sign of incredible wealth that the Romans would build this level of a road in the city of Tarsus to create a cleaning and sewer kind of whole thing going. So it was a very prominent, wealthy city. And they had one of the other things that was interesting about it, it was this kind of the center of the cult of Mithras. And I may not be saying his name right, but he's the god that the Roman soldiers loved to worship. Only men could worship Mithras, and he was mainly worshipped by Roman soldiers. So probably Tarsus was filled with Roman soldiers coming through to worship. So begin to place this. Try to keep this in the back of your mind as you're going to do the homework for the rest of this semester. Trying to keep this backstory, the B story of Saul's life, in, you know, kind of keep bringing it up as you're reading, because the very fact, just the story of Roman soldiers and Saul is a fascinating story of how he interacted with them throughout his life. But he grew up in a city where they came all the time to worship. So, moving on. We now have a pretty good idea of the B story. The B story are the circumstances surrounding a person's life. And knowing what Saul was born into can help us with this story. I'd also want to look at two other elements of a story, and it's very fun. It's called a beat sheet. And this is an abbreviated description of the main event. So the main things I'd love to cover in the story of Saul are the circumstances of his life, the choices his father made. I want to talk about those. And then Saul's personality. What can we learn from just some of the stuff? What can we assume Saul might have been like? Again, Beth's homework, it was so incredible. And as I read it this week, I kept thinking, what was in Saul's father's mind as he was making the choices he made for his son? In this backstory that I just gave you, in the midst of a very Roman city of Tarsus, a very sophisticated city, what was going on with the choices he made for his son? In fact, it almost felt like there was an intensity to Saul's upbringing that I kept feeling as I studied what the life of a young boy growing up to become a Pharisee, what it was like in the Pharisee's home. At times, it felt, the expectations on these young Jewish boys felt overwhelming, tedious. Did you feel almost boring at times? I mean, I don't know if any of you guys have worked with young boys or have a son or maybe a husband, you know, picturing my son doing the things that Beth described a young Jewish boy would be required of his education was mind-blowing. I wondered, it just felt suffocating, it lacked creativity to me, and I wondered, were they harsh? Was it harsh? Was it strict? Was it mean? What was going on? And we don't know, because we don't have any record of Saul's father. We don't have his diary. We don't have a journal of why he did what he did. But we can piece together a little bit using that backstory of the choices he made. Because Saul's father knew the story of his people. He knew the B story of the Jews. He knew how they had lost everything. And he watched, or he may not have watched, I don't know exactly his age, but he knew the day. And was told the story when Pompey walked into the Holy of Holies and desecrated the temple, but didn't destroy it. They were that close to losing everything again, just in 64 BC, not long before Saul's father was making these choices. He knew how close they were to losing everything if they didn't obey the law. Pharisees in the day, I know we, if we've read the Gospels, if we read Jesus' interactions with Pharisees, we have a pretty view of them. They're just ugh. But actually, in their day, they were a blessing to the people. They were the ones helping the people keep the law, practice the law, stay with the law, so that they wouldn't lose everything. They were the ones, and so for Saul's father to say, I want my son to be a Pharisee, he may have been saying, I don't want to lose what God's given us. I want my son to grow up to be a man of God, to teach the people God's law, to help us follow so that we will always have this land. We will always have his favor and his safety. His father, Saul's father, also saw the polytheistic Roman cults and practices. They had some pretty wild worship practices, wild types of pagan rituals. And he saw that. And to a monotheistic Jewish man, it must have been just an abomination to see how they lived their lives. And so he was saying, I don't want my son to be a part of this. I want to protect my son. I want to keep him from this crazy, crazy world. And when I started thinking like that, I realized, you know, Saul's father's not that different from us. We look at the young people around us and we feel sometimes maybe the same thing. Will they carry on the faith? Are we faithfully giving them a faith that worth carrying? Are we explaining it to them? Are we teaching them? Are we living it in front of them? And we think, you know, should I keep my kids, should I homeschool? Should they go to public school? Should they go to Christian school? What about college? Should they live at home and commute? I tried to decorate my basement really nice and set up a TV and have my kids live with me forever. You know, I just thought this will be great, but it didn't work. I didn't get very far. So Saul's father was living in an environment that sometimes feels a lot like ours. And then personality. I am sure he looked at this boy and said, this boy is different. And I want right now to go to the next part, and it's called the buildup. At the buildup, the action increases, the music crescendos, and our star takes the stage. So in our screenplay, Saul enters. And I'd love to think about, what was he like? If he could succeed in the educational environment Beth Moore so beautifully explained to us in our homework, what would that have meant he must be like? And as I was thinking, I thought, you know what? His personality, he probably, any boy that did well in that type of educational environment had to be competitive. He was probably a very competitive boy. Brilliant to the point of odd. In other words, nerd. He was compulsive. The descriptions, I don't know if you got to that part where he had to do all the different things with the phylacteries. If you guys have ever gone to Israel, I'm sure there's other places, but if you fly, when I've flown to Israel and back, like I do it every week, no, a couple times, I've only been to Israel twice. So the two times I went to Israel, on the flight over and back, there were many Orthodox Jews that are on the plane coming and going from America to Israel. And I really love it because a lot of times I feel like if a man sits next to me, he feels like, oh, here's a little woman. I'm going to take her armrest. You know, it's kind of like, hey, buddy, you know, this is my space. But an Orthodox Jew will not touch a Gentile woman. So they sit very, so I really like sitting next to them. So, you know, they don't go over on my armrest. It's like, oh, I can have that. So that, you know, they're just very careful. But then at all different times in the flight, depending on, you know, whatever is required, and I certainly don't know, all of a sudden they turn their little light on, they pull out their body, and they'll be dead asleep, and they'll wake up, and, you know, they put on their little things, and then they start this, you know, going, and I'm just blown away. And watching this going, oh my goodness, there has to be some kind of level of compulsiveness to do this successfully. And if you saw in the homework, Beth Moore said, he said, I was a very successful Pharisee. Paul tells us later in his writings, he was flawless, faultless as a Pharisee. He did all these things. You've got to have some little compulsive behavior to be able to do that. And he was uncaring what others thought. If you're going to succeed in that kind of environment where you're the star and you're doing everything right and you never mess up and you never make a mistake, you don't care about what everyone else is doing around you. You're not looking to be popular. You're looking to get it done. And so I don't think he was Mr. Popularity. I don't think he was insecure, and I don't think he worried about being liked by his classmates. Keep this in mind. Picture this little boy in this kind of environment. This is what Saul was living under. And realize that being a people pleaser would have disqualified him for the job God had ahead. This personality was very critical to what God was calling him to. And the next part of our screenplay is called the bump. This is the troublesome element, and I'm calling it God. God's entrance into our movie, into our screenplay, is a troublesome bump. But I'm not going to tell you what happens, because it's your homework for this week. You are going to hear the story of Saul meeting Jesus. Let me just give one little kind of spoiler alert. If we were writing the screenplay, this would be when the special effects come out. There would be bright flashes of light. There would be voices from heaven. There's a lot of really splashy stuff that's going to happen when you do your homework. But at this moment, I want to step back and just think again about Saul's father. I don't know. We have no, again, no biblical story of if Saul's father was alive at the time when Saul met Jesus. What possibly, if he was alive, would he have said, watching his son turn from this route that he had sacrificed for, this training and tutelage that he had provided for his son? Let me just tell you some of the things. First of all, obviously, his son was in a very strict school until he was 13. And then at the age of 13, he packs his son up to go to Jerusalem. Now, maybe in his day, that was a safer place than Tarsus. Maybe he was thinking, okay, Jerusalem, and probably there were about 1,000 boys in the rabbinical school. This is a good place for Saul versus Tarsus. But at the same time, you're giving up your son. And he's giving up the labor in their tent-making thing. He's giving up possible financial gain to send his son off to Jerusalem for this training. And so, and he's losing the relationship, having his son leave him. And so, suddenly, in all these sacrifices, all these financial things, you know, deprivations possibly Saul's father made to get his son to where he was, and now God enters. And his son, father possibly might have said, what a waste. What a waste of a great education, great opportunities. This guy was on the fast track to being the leader of the Sanhedrin, and now he's going to follow a carpenter? Now he's following this guy who's throwing all our laws and beliefs up in the air? This crazy guy that died and people are saying rose again? I don't know. I would love to imagine that maybe at some point Saul's father embraced Jesus. Maybe he came to know. I don't know. We don't know. But whatever Saul's father felt, none of the choices Saul's father made were a waste. None of the sacrifices for education were a waste. None of the assets he lost in the world of trade were a waste. Every aspect of Paul's life prior to his conversion prepared him for what the Lord had. Let me just summarize it for you, and you'll see these more and more as you do your homework. His Jewish heritage and Roman citizenship, like I was explaining how suddenly every Jew in Tarsus got to be a Roman citizen, just this arbitrary granting of Roman citizenship, which was very unusual. It gave Paul the ability, Saul or Paul, the ability to travel all over the world and to appear before some of the most powerful leaders in the world. His training by Gamaliel that Beth had us read about when he went as a young 13-year-old down to Jerusalem was trained under this amazing rabbi. This training is what they call a diatribe. It's a debate, question, and answer style. And when I read that, I went, oh, that sounds like Jesus. Every time anybody asked Jesus a question, he'd answer with a question, and then there'd be another question. Well, that was the style of the rabbis. They would question and answer in their in the way they would learn or study. And a rabbi was not only part preacher, but they were trained to be lawyers. They were trained to be ready to prosecute before courts or defend the accused in a court. So Paul, in this amazing training that he received in Jerusalem, was being prepared for something so much bigger than what he probably his father imagined. And then his skill as a tent maker, when he went back, he left Jerusalem, went back to Tarsus, probably in his early 20s. So he physically was never in the same city as Jesus while he was while Jesus was on the earth before his death. They were kind of crossing paths. But when he went back to Tarsus, he went back to learn to be a tent maker because rabbis had to have a trade. And Paul, as a tent maker, traveled the world, was able to pay for his travels through tent making wherever he went. Plus, it was a great networking. He met Priscilla and Aquila and all these amazing other people in this trade. So all these things that possibly Saul's father or Gamaliel or any of the people that had trained Saul when he made this decision to follow Jesus would look at that and say, what a waste. All this great training. But you see, in God's story, in God's way, our circumstances, our choices, our personality, none of it is a waste. And that's the A story. The A story is the main story that really has been running through, that we've kind of been dancing around the edges of, but it's truly the main story. And it's a story with a twist. Because actually, it's not that God entered at that bump moment, but that God has been here all the time. And in the rest of yours this semester, as you study this homework, as you come and talk about it, you are going to see the circumstances, the privileges, the benefits, all this that has been happening in Saul's life. You are going to see none of it go to waste. That Saul gave everything to Jesus, and all of it was used. And remember how I was saying how he argued so eloquently? I'm going to give you a little cheat, because it was such an exciting moment for me. In lesson 7, you are going to read the story. This is the Roman amphitheater where Saul stood. This actually is in Israel. But Saul stood right about the place where I am taking the picture from. That would be Saul's vision of this amphitheater. Saul stood here defending the gospel eloquently, brilliantly, before Governor Felix, the Roman governor, and Roman soldiers and Roman citizens, and all the people gathered to hear this defense of the gospel. We'll learn about. You look to the left, there's a really handsome boy running up the stairs, and then on the right, there's a really handsome boy in green. That's my husband. They were racing. Guess who won? But you can see then by the perspective, and when they sat up there and I talked, they could hear me. You didn't need, the way these buildings were structured, you didn't need microphones and things. But I stood there as they were sitting there, and I was tongue-tied. I thought, I don't know what I would say. What would I say to defend my faith before the governor of the Roman world? What would I say? And yet everything of Saul's circumstances, personality, the choices his father made, all of it was leading to this moment, as well as so many others we're going to see, where he defended the gospel passionately, eloquently, beautifully before the rulers of the world. And it was a very chilling, amazing experience to stand there. Helen Rosevere is an 88-year-old woman living in Ireland right now. She was a British UK missionary to the Congo, a doctor from 1953 to 1973. There was horrible unrest in the Congo, just like there still is, unfortunately. And she was captured, she was imprisoned, she was raped, she was beaten. But in the midst of all of this, she's continued in her work in the Congo, built hospitals. Amazing, amazing woman. Her books, the story of all of this is placed in two of her books, Give Me This Mountain and God Gave Us a Valley. Well, back in the early 1980s, I got to meet her and hear her speak. And I actually, after hearing her and then reading her books, when it came time for my third daughter to be named, the name Helen was the name we picked. It's my grandmother's name, but it was also because of Helen Rosevere. And I gave the books to Helen, my daughter, and she has read them and treasures them. And in fact, I just sent her some new pieces of Helen's story to my daughter Helen, and she was just so blown away, so blessed by this amazing woman that blessed me. Well, back in the 80s, back before any of you were born, but back in the 80s, church ladies would dress up when they went to missionary luncheons. And I was part of a very large church. There were hundreds of women gathering. And I remember what I wore. I had this really cute, it was when we wore those wide bias skirts. Again, you guys weren't even born, but some of you might remember we had these wide kind of circle skirts, and I had this beige plaid, and I had a little beige jacket, and I had beige pumps, and we wore stockings back then because we were ladies and had to wear stockings. And, I was dressed to impress because my husband was on staff. We were pretty newly married, but he was the high school director, and I wanted to fit in with all the church ladies. So I got there, and it was very fun. Oh, and back then, the 80s, my hair was much bigger. And you know what's so sad, you guys? I actually used a curling iron on this tonight. That's it. That's all I got. But back then, I tried harder, and I think I got a little more bigger look. So anyway, I was looking good. And Helen Rosevere gets up to speak, but instead of telling her story on the Congo, she told the story God was writing in her life at that time. And it was a story. She had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she has this delightful way of politely arguing with God. And she, in her lovely British accent, acted out this argument she was having with God to let him know that cancer was an inconvenience and an interruption to her plans. She had so many things yet to do with her life, and breast cancer was not one of the things on her list. And as she was discussing and telling God he had it all wrong, she claims he answered her in a very gentlemanly way. Then she turned to all of us and reassured us that God is a perfect gentleman. He will not make you do things. He will just politely ask. So he turned to her, and God speaks with a British accent. So I'm going to do my best. Again, here I am pretending tonight. I'm going to try a British accent, and I don't do these. Like I said, I was a criminal justice major, not a theater major. But God turned to her, and he said, "Helen, if you don't mind, I have a woman in a bed to see. And she doesn't know me, and I'd like to put you in bed to be, so that you could tell her that I love her. It's only body, Helen. May I have it?" And when he put it that way, she said she couldn't refuse. And so instead of going through breast cancer in anger and alone, she let God have it. And she said impromptu Bible studies would break out in the waiting room, because she was sitting with all the indignities of cancer with a group of women going through all the indignities of breast cancer, and they were suffering. And together, she was able to tell them about Jesus and tell them about how much he loved them. And then she gave us a challenge, all us lovely ladies sitting in this luncheon, and she said, "If you are, whatever suffering you are facing, could you give it to God to use? It's just body." But when she got to that part of the talk, I couldn't breathe. And I felt like everyone in the room disappeared, and it was just me, and it was just God. And he was asking me the same question. Because I had just been told by the head of a university, a very prominent university, that I would never have children. That he looked through all our infertility tests and said, "I'm sorry, you will never have children." And I felt like God was saying, "Paula, it's only body. May I have it?" Well, I got out of there as fast as I could. I don't remember speaking to a single person. I was blowing my nose on my skirt in the car. I was sobbing. I was just a wreck. I don't even know how I got home. I have no memory of even being home. All I remember is this conversation I had with God. It was not a polite British lady. I am a crass American who knows way too many cuss words, and I was angry, and I was yelling at God. But eventually, I do remember falling on the bed and saying, "Okay, it's only body, you can have it. It's only body, you can have it." And my story is very small compared to the suffering I know a lot of you have gone through, or the people you love are going through, because God did eventually open my womb. I had four children. But those years of infertility were not a waste, because God gave me a chance so many times to sit across from another woman sobbing and just saying, "I know the indignities. I know how vulgar the tests and the questions and the things they put you through to see what's wrong. Why can't you have a child? I know the monthly disappointment." And then I had to go and tell Steve, no baby, nothing this time. And to watch his face every month just fall. And I knew that. And so I had this moment that I could sit with other women, and God decided to use it, and it wasn't a waste. The other thing I learned during that time is these four children he eventually did give me, they have never been mine. They were never mine to have. And like I said, I have decorated the basement. I've tried to set it up so they'll live with me. I've offered to put a refrigerator down there, anything I can. And tomorrow I am driving down to Metro Airport, and I'm putting my son on a plane to Australia for 6 months to do a mission experience. And I hate it. I've done it before, and I'm doing it again. And I put my daughter on a plane January 2nd to go out to law school in California, and I couldn't breathe as I was leaving the airport. I'm like, "Oh, I can't do this, God." But he keeps saying, "Paula, it's only body. Can I use it? Can can they be mine and not yours? And I loosen my grip and I say, okay, God, they're yours. They're not mine. As you look back in your life at the circumstances, the shameful, angry choices, even these personality things that torment you, do you hear God asking in this lovely, gentlemanly way, could I have those? Could I use those? Could I use all the things you consider a waste? I know if you were going to write your own screenplay, you might say, okay, Paula, I'll write my screenplay, but you know what? It's going to be, I'm only going to let the things in there that, you know, that I'm going to control my image throughout the screen, this movie. It's not going to have everything. It's just going to have what I want it to have. And then if I said, well, what if you gave your screenplay of your life to God? And some of you may say, you know what? I know what would happen. God would take out a big red pen and he would start just crossing things out of my life and saying, I can't, oh, why did you do that? How can I ever use you? You can't go to church if you've done that. What do you think? You can't teach. What are you standing up in front of Insights Women for? You're disqualified. You can't do it. And this is what we picture. But you know, actually, what we've learned through Saul and what we have learned in our own lives is when we give God our screenplays, he's using a yellow highlighter. And he goes, oh my goodness, I can use this. This is gonna make it mean so much to our other hurting people. Let me have this. Give this to me. I'll rewrite a little bit of it. I'll change some of this. I'll redeem it. I'll clean it up. Oh, let me have it. You may think you fall flat, but actually that's the best part of the story. Because that's when I show up and I can tell you that I love you. And it's not a waste. Because there's going to come a time when a woman is going to sit across from you at the kitchen table or at a restaurant over a cup of coffee, and you're going to tell her the horrors and the shame and the moments of your life that are just you don't want in that screenplay. But if you give them to God, and then you tell this other friend what God has done in those moments, God uses them. Beth chose this verse at the end, as our treasure for day one. Paul says, God, who set me apart from my mother's womb and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles. God wants our story, even if it's filled with wasted years, wasted choices, wasted opportunities, because he can reveal his son in our wasted lives. By his grace, he can use it, and he longs to, because there is a world of hurt all around us, and they don't need cleaned up, beautiful church ladies. They need real ladies who have suffered, who have struggled, and in the midst of it have experienced God's love shining out, revealing his son in your life. Let me pray. Lord, I thank you so much that truly you have set us apart. You called us. You have longed for us to see you. You've been there all along in our story, even when we were running as fast as we could away from you. And in all the waste of our lives, you long to make beauty. You long to take the ashes and create beauty. You long to take the broken things and make them beautiful. And they become beautiful, Lord, when we offer them to you and when we tell the story to the people you bring in our lives who need encouragement, who need to know you love even in the midst of the deepest, deepest darkness. Lord, I pray you give us the courage to turn these things over to you and to give you the opportunity to use us to reveal your son in us. We pray this in his name. Amen. Amen.